We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
Las Vegas. It's so much more than just a city.
It's a feeling. It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction, knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Tens of millions of people share that feeling every year.
And I'm just one of them. Here to take you to the world-famous Vegas Strip
and beyond.
My name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to episode number 175 of Jeff Does Vegas. Before we get rolling for this episode of the podcast, I want to thank everyone who checked out the last episode, another world-famous Jeff Does Vegas trip report. We did a recap on my most recent trip to Las Vegas from February 4th to 6th, 2024, including my hotel experience at the Horseshoe, meals both on and off the strip, and some of the attractions and shows I had a chance to take in. If you haven't listened as of yet, jump into the archives at jeffdoesvegas.com or search out episode number 174, the February Trip Report. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. If you're a fan of Vegas-related movies and pop culture, chances are that you've heard of the infamous Black Book. This is a list of people who are essentially banned from entering any gaming establishment in the state of Nevada for any reason, as was highlighted by Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro in this scene from the 1995 Martin Scorsese classic, Casino.
Let's say, for instance, I want to go into a restaurant, which happens to be in the casino, to get one of those sandwiches out.
Forget it. You can't even set foot in the parking lot. That's how serious it is.
In other words, I'm
in so many words, yes.
So exactly how does one end up in the Black Book? And more importantly, is there a way to get out of it? My guest for this episode of the podcast is here to answer those questions and many more. Back for another conversation is one of my favorite guests of all time, Jeff Schumacher, Vice President of Exhibits and Programs at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas. Jeff and I went in depth on the history of the Black Book, including when it came into existence and why, some of the famous and infamous names that have landed in the book, the consequences of having your name in the Black Book, and much more. Please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Schumacher.
It's officially called the List of Excluded Persons. which doesn't sound as good as the Black Book. The reason it got the nickname the Black Book is because in its original form, the bound covers of the document were black. But the nickname itself also calls to mind the term blacklisting, right? Which is very much in the news when the list of excluded persons was created in 1960. Today, interestingly enough, most people would find the contents of the Black Book on the Nevada Gaming Control Board's website. So it's not really a Black Book anymore.
So I assume back in the day, it was one of those things that was kind of hidden away in a back office somewhere of, you know, some person that they, when it would go to manually actually writing it into the book, not so much anymore.
Yeah, you know, back in the day, it was like a binder, really. And this would be the important thing is there would be multiple copies made because they'd be distributed to the casinos, right? Every casino needed a copy or more than one copy of the Black Book so that they could, if they saw somebody walking through the casino who looked like familiar or suspicious, they could check the Black Book and see if that person should not be in the casino. So there were lots of copies made, at least dozens, if not probably hundreds of copies that were made. But yeah, it was not something that was widely distributed. There were no published versions that went out to the public or anything like that.
You mentioned that it was originally created back in 1960, and I assume there was a catalyst that led to the creation of this list. What was that catalyst?
Yeah, the primary catalyst was it was created as a way to show that Nevada was getting serious about regulating the casino industry. And this there's a whole history I can chart very quickly for you. And this chatter throughout the 1950s that the federal government was going to step in and either shut down Nevada's casinos or that they were going to impose some kind of severe regulations or taxation of their own. And this idea originated with the Kefauver Committee hearings in 1950 and 1951. And as you know, one of those hearings was held in the Mott Museum's courtroom on the second floor. And during that hearing, the committee asked a number of local people involved in the gaming industry and in gaming regulation to talk about how it all worked here. And there were really the findings of the Kefauver Committee were that gambling was bad for society, and that it needed to be, if not outlawed entirely, it needed to be heavily regulated to keep, you know, organized crime out. So that was the beginning of it. And then in 1955, investigators revealed the hidden involvement of Meyer Lansky, the great, you know, grand poobah, if you will, of organized crime at that time, that he was involved in the hidden ownership of the Thunderbird Hotel on the Las Vegas Strip. So this clearly was a blow to gaming regulation in Nevada, because here one of the most infamous mobsters in the country has a hidden ownership in a casino here. And then just 2 years later, this is followed by the attempted assassination of New York Mafia boss Frank Costello. And what was learned from that, from the investigation of that shooting, was that Costello had a hidden interest in the newly opened Tropicana Hotel. So all of this, you know, Nevada's taking these hits during the 50s. There was even one more, which was there was the revelations about the Teamsters Union Pension Fund, which was controlled by Jimmy Hoffa. That it had loaned tens of millions of dollars to mob-connected hotels in Las Vegas. So clearly the public view of Las Vegas was that the mob was all over the place and that the state of Nevada wasn't doing much about it. Now, the state of Nevada did two things before they created the Black Book. First thing they did was they created the Nevada Gaming Control Board and the Nevada Gaming Commission. And the Nevada Gaming Control Board was the investigative arm of gaming regulation. It was a new entity, and it was the investigative arm. And then the Gaming Commission would set the policies and make the final decisions about, you know, licensing and so forth. So this is, these entities took the place of the Tax Commission. The Tax Commission previously had been regulating Nevada casinos, and they weren't doing a great job. So they created the Nevada Gaming Control Board and the Nevada Gaming Commission. It took a while for those entities to get up and running the way, certainly not even close to the way they are now. They were still learning about how to regulate casinos. But there was a step forward to show, you know, that Nevada could handle its own affairs and keep the feds at bay.
It's almost funny, the mob being involved in the gaming industry in Nevada at that time. I mean, it was almost kind of like it was an open secret, wasn't it? I mean, people just knew it was there, but it just kind of was like, well, we'll let it do its thing. And maybe if we need to, we'll step in and do something.
Well, that's right. You know, there was a sense, first of all, there was a sense in Nevada that a lot of the guys running the casinos at that time were very talented gambling operators, right? They knew what they were doing. They knew how to run a casino, which is something that nobody was ever trained to do legally in the past, right? It was illegal all over the country except in Nevada. And so if you were to learn how to run a casino, learn how to handle table games and all of the complexities of setting all of the rules, that you needed somebody to know what they're doing. So where do you find those people? You find them in the illegal gambling operations all over the country. So those folks came to Las Vegas to go legit, as it were, and Nevada recognized that and said, you know what? These guys were maybe have a criminal record for illegal gambling or maybe for even prohibition violations, but they are in Las Vegas now and they're grandfathered in. So we're going to leave them alone. So a great example of that would be Mo Dalens, right? Mo Dalens was a bootlegger during Prohibition out of Cleveland. He owned and operated casinos in Ohio as well as in Kentucky. They were all illegal, but they were, you know, sort of well-run casino operators, much like Las Vegas would be. And so when he came to Las Vegas in 1950 and was involved with the Desert Inn, he was a very popular figure in Las Vegas, well-respected businessman, as opposed to being seen as a hoodlum. So he never, there was never any risk that Mo Dalens had been placed in Nevada's black book. He was someone who was kind of grandfathered in. And there were other people like that as well. And especially in the 50s and early 60s, you were seeing individuals with considerable criminal records who were still getting gaming licenses. And another one was Charles Babe Baron. Charles Baron had actually been in the military, but he was involved with Chicago mob for years and in Havana as well with Meyer Lansky and others. And yet he was licensed without any problem.
It's interesting that you bring up Frank Costello and the Tropicana, because I've been doing a fair bit of research into the Tropicana, preparing for an episode about the Tropicana with the Tropicana closing down and such.
Yeah.
And as a little bit of a side note, I guess, sort of a sidetrack conversation with the Trop, the organized crime history of the Tropicana, it's one of those properties. We talked about this a little bit with the Benny Binion discussion, in that people immediately, I think, with pop culture, they go to the Flamingo, they go to the Stardust, they go to those stories. The Tropicana isn't one of those stories that really comes up. But as you say, like, there was a fair bit of organized crime involvement with the Tropicana as well, with, as you say, Frank Costello and others.
Well, there were two periods in particular when that was true, right? When the Tropicana opened in the late 50s, that was definitely mob involvement there. And then this recurred in the 70s. And the decision was made by Nick Pileggi and Martin Scorsese. Okay, we're going to tell the story of the Stardust Hotel and the skimming that was going on there and the personalities involved. He could easily have written a book and then made a movie about the Tropicana at that time, because it was almost like this parallel story that was happening. And almost the same result, too. They had a big RICO case, RICO trial in the early 80s and pushed the mob out of the Tropicana. So yeah, the Tropicana is a major part of the mob history of Las Vegas.
Let's talk a little bit about the selection criteria and what lands a person in the Black Book. You mentioned, I mean, there were guys that, as you say, had very considerable criminal records that didn't end up in the Black Book. But what did it take for somebody to actually get put on that list?
So there's a pretty interesting history to this, and I'll summarize it. You know, when the first Black Book was issued in 1960, there were 11 men placed in the Black Book. And they were placed there without any formal notification, no administrative hearing, no notice of any kind. And basically, these 11 names were decided upon by one gaming regulator, R.J. Abaticcio. And R.J. Abaticcio said, these are the 11 individuals who we think are the greatest danger and bring the most discredit to Nevada's gaming industry. And so the list included, famously, Sam Giancana, Murray Humphreys, Marshall Caifano from Chicago, included Nick and Carl Savella out of Kansas City, and Trigger Mike Coppola out of New York as examples. And there were a couple out of L.A. as well. And they were simply placed in there based on their reputation. It was not any kind of really in-depth study that led to their inclusion. So that's how it started. But then, you know, the whole process evolved, and there was all these different periods of time. So to give you an idea, so during the Black Book's first 30 years, really about 30 years of that, a person's reputation played the biggest role in whether they were added to the Black Book. That was true of the first 11 that we've discussed, as well as others such as Tony Spilotro, Chris Petty, out of San Diego, Joey Cusimano, who is still in the Black Book today. Now, in more recent years, the control board has focused more on like casino cheaters and others who kind of present a more identifiable threat to the casinos, you know, something tangible as opposed to just on based on the reputation.
With those original 11, as you say, you mentioned it was just based strictly on reputation. And there were guys on that list that it sounds like they really had, other than being involved in, say, organized crime families that maybe had their hands a little bit in Vegas here and there, they really didn't have a lot of involvement with Las Vegas. They weren't in the city. They weren't around. As you say, they were New York, Chicago, L.A. They really didn't have a lot to do with Vegas per se.
That's right. I mean, one individual who did seem to have a lot of interest in Las Vegas at that time was Sam Giancana, who, you know, had spent a lot of time in Las Vegas. But Murray Humphreys, you know, not much. Nick and Carl Savella at that time were not deeply involved in Las Vegas. They would be later at the Tropicana Hotel. And Trigger Mike Coppola, I mean, he was a New York guy, primarily involved in the numbers racket in Harlem and elsewhere. And so, yeah, it was almost like Abaticcio just said, you know, I've been reading the newspapers. I knew who the bad guys are. You know, let's put them in the book. But it became much more organized later. But even into the 1970s and 80s, you're still looking at mobsters being, you know, the primary target.
Talking about the investigation process a little bit, and you mentioned sort of the process a little bit on how an investigation is triggered. What does trigger an investigation nowadays, as opposed to back then when, as you say, it was just reading the newspaper and saying, hey, this guy seems like a bad guy, let's put him on the list. Today, I would imagine there's a whole process involving a whole bunch of different people and different departments. And fill us in a little bit on that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's still very subjective, right? There are 36 individuals in the Nevada Black Book. But like, and we'll get to this, but like Atlantic City has, for Atlantic City gambling, there are like hundreds and hundreds of people on their list. So they made a different kind of strategic decision about how they would go about adding people to their Black Book. Nevada still is fairly selective, but basically what happens is, you know, gaming control board investigators will work in collaboration with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, as well as law enforcement agencies and gaming regulators in other states. And they'll make a determination that they want to pursue a particular individual for inclusion in the Black Book. And nowadays, you know, there's a notification process, there's a hearing process. So this didn't happen until much later with the Gaming Control Board. But now you can bring your lawyer and you can put together a defense, you know, and these hearings are public. So you can, you know, kind of, you know, try to defend yourself from inclusion in the Black Book. It's a whole process that has played out, you know, dozens of times now since the late 70s. And, you know, Oscar Goodman, our former mayor, former defense attorney, he defended a number of individuals who were nominated for the Black Book and unsuccessfully, but you know, he certainly made a lot of noise about it at the time.
I get the suspicion that the process, particularly back in the day, and it sounds like even now a little bit, as you say, it's not like a standard criminal trial or civil trial where you've got specific rights or certain rights that you're defending. It's more of a, almost sounds like it's more of a character defense than anything.
Well, that's right. And you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not, you know, prepared to go into the nitty gritty of it. But the bottom line is that there is no like rule that says you have to have been convicted of a certain number of crimes or certain types of crimes. You don't have to have been convicted of any crimes to be added to the Black Book. You could, in the end, the Gaming Control Board can nominate you based on your reputation alone. And so, for example, you go back to Tony Spilotro, you know, one of the most notorious mobsters in Las Vegas history, right? Well, he didn't have much of a record of convictions, right? He that's the thing about Tony Spilotro is he may, in fact, have killed more than 20 people, as the FBI claimed, never convicted of any of those murders. And he was sort of the Teflon Tony in a lot of ways. He was able to get away with a lot of stuff, is what we believe. But, you know, in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. And so he was, you know, he went into the Black Book not having much of a criminal record to speak of.
Is there anything else that would trigger an investigation? Like, would there be, say, a complaint from one of the casino corporations or casino owners if somebody seems a little bit sketchy? Would, say, for example, Caesars go to the Gaming Control Board or Gaming Commission and say, hey, we've had this person in, they've taken us for $250,000. We think there's something weird going on. Can you guys look into this? Is that a thing? Is that a process?
Well, I have a shorter answer and a longer answer. My shorter answer to you is I don't know a specific person in the Black Book who was who got there via a casino complaint, a specific casino going to the control board. Now, that may very well have happened. But what I will say is that there are a number of these casino cheaters who are in the Black Book who were kicked out of casinos again and again and again before any kind of law enforcement activity presented itself. So when you're building a case to add somebody to the Black Book, oftentimes you're relying on the casinos to let you know exactly what this person has been up to. And so there's definitely collaboration, if you will, between the security agencies within these casinos and these casino companies with the Gaming Control Board. All the casinos want a good excuse to keep those kind of people out. So I would think that they'd be cooperative.
Yeah, I would imagine they would go pretty hard to keep. If somebody's taking them for a lot of money, they don't want that person in the casino.
Right. And a lot of them, you know, these casinos tend to like self-govern, you know. I mean, they will take care of these people themselves. I don't mean anything rough. I just mean they'll eject people from the casino for cheating or for perceived cheating or for card counting. And they may handle these things themselves a lot of the time. But, you know, when something becomes a little more egregious than the Gaming Control Board, they're obligated to let the Gaming Control Board know what has transpired. So there's definitely collaboration.
I love that you clarified the meaning of take care of things now versus back in the day.
There were different ways to handle those things.
We talked a little bit about some of the notable names that are in the Black Book, guys like Tony Spilotro and such. Who are some of the other big names that maybe got placed into the book?
Yeah, another one is related to Tony Spilotro, and that's Lefty Rosenthal. Frank Lefty Rosenthal was the Chicago mob's manager for the Stardust Hotel in the 70s. Interestingly, he ended up leaving Las Vegas in 1983 after someone tried to blow him up in his car. But after that, he nonetheless was nominated and placed in the Black Book a few years later. So I guess control board, better late than never in their mind, I guess. And let's make sure he doesn't come back. Another one was Joey Cusimano. Joey Cusimano was a New York mob guy who, but he was definitely working with Tony Spilotro in Las Vegas in the 70s and 80s. And Cusimano, though, had his crimes, if you will, any kind of a rap sheet that he had in Las Vegas was involving labor racketeering. So he was involved with, you know, the culinary union and other unions, which, you know, in theory, doesn't have anything to do with the operation of a casino, right? And he was not a threat to the casino. Nonetheless, in the 90s, he was placed in the Black Book. And I talked to Joey within the last 6 months, and I can tell you that he has been living in Las Vegas this whole time he's been unable to enter a casino during any of that time. And it really chafes on him because he feels like, hey, you know, maybe I've served my time and I'm not a threat anymore. He's in his 80s now. And nonetheless, he's in the Black Book and he cannot enter a casino.
Is there an appeal process or a process for somebody like him to try to get out of the Black Book? Like, and I know I kind of wanted to hit on this more in depth a little bit later, but for somebody like him, can he appeal to the board and say, I've served my time, I think I'm okay? Like, can you take me off the list?
So there is the kind of the short answer, long answer again. Probably the only way to get removed from the Black Book realistically is to die. That will get you removed from the Black Book. There theoretically is an appeal process, but I have spoken with individuals at the Gaming Control Board about this in the recent years, and no one has really attempted it yet because they don't feel a great deal of confidence that they're going to succeed in being removed. And in the meantime, this suddenly becomes a very public thing again. Right. And there's all kinds of hearings, whether they're in court or administrative hearings, and all their dirty laundry is put out again after all these years. And so I think a number of individuals have decided that they will not appeal formally. They've made public appeals. You know, Frank Sitro is in the Black Book, and Frank is a very vocal critic of the Black Book and very much wants to be removed from it. But he has never actually gone and taken the step of going to court to try to be removed. So, interestingly, there is one exception. There has been one exception to this rule, and it involved a man named Ruby Kolot. And that name might ring a bell. Ruby was involved with Modelitz at the Desert Inn Hotel. He was a longtime part of the Cleveland Syndicate along with Delitz. He was added to the Black Book in 1965. There's a complicated story, but it had to do with an alleged extortion attempt involving an oil company in Colorado. So it didn't have anything directly to do with the Desert Inn. It had to do with this other racket that Kolon was involved in, alleged racket. Well, Kolon is added to the Black Book, and before a matter of short amount of time later, he's removed from the Black Book. Now, why did that happen? Well, it appears that this whole Kolon matter got mixed up in Nevada gubernatorial politics. Now, it was Governor Grant Sawyer who was involved in the decision to add Kolon to the Black Book, as a way to show Nevada's integrity to the federal government. Like, here we are again. This is a bad character. We're putting it in the black book. You don't need federal involvement here. We got it under control. But Kolod, I don't know the sequence of events, but Kolod had contributed $200,000 to the campaign of Paul Laxalt, who was Sawyer's primary opponent in the upcoming election. So, you know, suddenly Sawyer is like, this has become political now that you've added Kolod and you're going to be punished for it. So Sawyer takes Kolod, or Sawyer and the gaming regulators take Kolod out of the black book, presumably to try to save Sawyer's re-election. Well, despite Kolod being removed from the black book, Sawyer lost the race to Laxalt. Interesting side note, not a single individual was placed in the black book during Laxalt's term as governor. Not one. So as much as, you know, there's a lot of good things to say about Paul Laxalt as a, you know, a Nevadan and someone who had a great contribution to Nevada in different ways, he kind of was in the pocket of the mob at that time. You know, I'm not saying he did everything illegal or unethical, but clearly he was taking money from the mob, and he wanted the mob believes that he was their guy.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
Are there any names or any people that aren't in the book that are a little bit surprising to you? For just pulling a name out of thin air, Frank Culotta, did he get it ever placed in the book? And I mean, he was an actual convicted criminal.
You know, you would think that Frank Culotta would have been placed in the black book, would have been nominated for the black book. What ended up happening was Culotta, he became a government witness, right? He became a rat, if you will, in the parlance of the mob. And he started testifying against other mobsters. And that was in the 80s. And he was in witness protection outside of Nevada. So he was kind of out of sight, out of mind for a while. And then when he came back, I think he probably was perceived in the mid-90s when he came back to Las Vegas, he was probably perceived as not being a real threat. He was largely finished with his criminal career and had moved on. So that would be my guess as to why he is not in. If you look at the list over the years, what you find is very, very few New York mobsters were ever added to the list. And, why? I don't know. I mean, you had the five families, right? You had in New York, and the bosses were of Gambino and Lucchese and Bonanno and Colombo families. They were all very, very powerful people, and they were in one way or another involved in Las Vegas, yet none of them was ever nominated for the Black Book, and it's not clear to me why. Meanwhile, though, a guy like Richard the Fixer Perry, who was involved in fixing the sporting events, right, and then became involved with UNLV basketball team, very unsavory situation in which the photos were published in the Review Journal showing Richard Perry in a hot tub with a bunch of basketball players from UNLV. This was in the early 90s. And it was certainly not a good scene. So even though he probably was not a real threat to the casinos, he was seen as having an unsavory reputation. And so he was placed in the black book. And then probably one of the most classic people that deserve to be in the black book, that's John Vaccaro. He was a convicted slot cheater, and he had not just individually, but he put together a whole team of slot cheaters that he was in charge of. John Vaccaro was placed in the black book. That made sense. But then they also put his wife in the black book. And you think, well, what did she have to do with it? Well, in fact, she had a little bit to do with it, because one of the things they do with slot cheating, especially in those days, was you had to have somebody who would collect the winnings, right? So oftentimes these slot teams would, they would bring women in to be the collectors, as they call them. And women would sit at the slot machine while it was being manipulated in one way or another. And then they would collect the winnings and they would get a picture taken with the big check. I just won $1,500 or whatever it is. And then they would walk out. Well, Sandra was one of those people and she was involved in that way. But I'm not sure without her husband whether she was much of a threat.
Let's talk a little bit about the consequences of getting placed into the Black Book. I mean, the obvious consequence is you can't walk into a casino anywhere in the state of Nevada. Are there any other consequences of going into the book?
Well, I would say there are two other things. One is just a nuance on the casino business. As you know, in Las Vegas today, casinos are not just casinos, right? They have bowling alleys, they have movie theaters, they have skating rinks, they have all kinds of ancillary activities for people to engage in. Obviously, the restaurants. And you can't, as I understand it, if you're in the Black Book, you cannot use any of those facilities either. So let's say you're a big moviegoer, right? The large majority of the movie theaters in Las Vegas are attached to casinos. Now, there are a couple that aren't, but that really limits your choices if you are in the Black Book. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I would imagine that being in the Black Book would certainly be a red flag for banks or other individual or hiring, you know, people who want to hire you for something. I don't know if you're required to disclose that you're in the Black Book or not, but it wouldn't be too hard for people to figure that out. And so if you want to get a business loan or you want to, you know, get employed and become employed by someone, it certainly could be a deterrent for that.
If somebody decides to sort of thumb their nose at this whole exclusion and go get that sandwich because they really like that sandwich, what are the consequences of not following that? Is it a felony in the state of Nevada to ignore a Black Book exclusion, or what would be the consequence of that?
So the consequences, I understand it, would primarily be on the gaming establishment. So if, you know, if it turns out that the gaming regulators learned that a Black Book member was had been inside a casino, that casino then would be subject to scrutiny. And gaming regulators would go, well, why did you let Joe Blow into your casino? And this can this could lead to fines or even you could lose your gaming license. Now, that losing the license hasn't actually happened, but there's one example that I found. In 1974, regulators learned that Kansas City Mafia boss Nick Sabella was staying at the Dunes Hotel. And in fact, the Dunes had given him a nice room and they were taking care of him. The Dunes was questioned about this, and the Dunes came up with some very flimsy excuses about, you know, how Nick Sabella ended up in one of their suites. Well, the Dunes was fined $10,000 for allowing that to happen, which was not a small amount of money in 1974. So there are potential penalties for casinos. The casinos then are obligated to, A, to keep an eye out for these individuals, and two, to let regulators know if there's been any kind of a skirt, you know, somebody who's come in the casino. I think most of these Black Book members don't go in casinos. They don't want to make a fuss, but, you know, it could happen.
So I do find it interesting that it is almost sort of self-enforcement amongst the casinos, in that they are the ones that are in charge of making sure that these people are not coming into their establishments.
That's true. And I will say, though, that, you know, gaming regulators in Nevada have the right to go into any casino, any part of any casino at any time. So you do, part of the routine of being a gaming investigator in Nevada is you go spend time in these casinos watching what's happening. You watch the table games, you watch the slot machines, you watch everything that's going on there, look around at the customers. And so it's possible that you, as a regular, might in fact see someone from the Black Book in a casino. That would be, if you saw them before the casino saw them, that would probably not be great for the casino. So there is that. And then there's also, you know, people just talk, right? So you could easily see someone in the casino, working for the casino, calling the game control board anonymously and saying, oh, Frank Citro was hanging out in our casino last night. You know, not that he does that. I'm just using it as an example. And that they could, you know, start investigating it that way.
I would imagine with advances in technological or in technology, I should say, with things like facial recognition and things like that, the enforcement of the exclusion list has probably become a little bit easier for the casinos in that now they can use all this facial recognition software that's out there and go, oh, hey, that dude is on the list. He's not supposed to be here. Go get him. And I would assume it's just a lot easier now.
Yeah, I think that's true. From what I understand from security people in the casino business, the facial recognition is helpful. It's not foolproof, you know, that it's not perfect, but it definitely helps. And what it does is, you know, back in the day, and this is still true to some extent, you had what was known as the eye in the sky, right? There were individuals literally watching the casino floor, looking for cheaters, looking for bad dealers or whatever. And now you have all these added cameras and you can see things that are happening. Now, the way the casinos will tell you is interesting. They will say, well, facial recognition is really helpful to us because we can recognize our high rollers and our other favorite guests. And then we can know they're in the casino. We can go take care of them better, right? That's one way to look at it. The other way would be to say we can find bad actors and get rid of them.
Let's talk about the updating the book. It's not something that happens very often, is it? I mean, it really does have to be an update to the book really does have to happen for some specific reason, doesn't it?
It seems like they generally nominate in recent years, they nominate somebody about once a year. And so it is not I think one of the reasons that they probably don't nominate a lot of people is there's a lot of work involved, right? A lot of research, a lot of preparation, a lot of, you know, notifications and hearing time. And I'm guessing the Game Control Board does not have unlimited resources to do this. So that's one thing. They can probably only handle one or two per year. And then the second thing is they're just looking for people who rise to the level where it really becomes an obligation on the part of the control board to add them. The two most recent nominations that led to people being added to the Black Book are quite interesting, really interesting. The first one in 2022 was a man named Kendrick Weatherspoon. Now, Kendrick Weatherspoon was not involved in gambling, per se, not in the mob. He was a sex and drug trafficker. He is a sex and drug trafficker, particularly a sex trafficker in the sense that what we used to call, in the old days, we call a pimp, right? And he would solicit women to become prostitutes in the casinos, and then he would serve as their pimp. So he also was convicted of drug trafficking. So this was somewhat of a new angle for the Game Control Board. But it was kind of a logical one, right? You know, human trafficking, sex trafficking is a very serious problem in the world right now. And if casinos are the venues through which that illegal act is occurring, then the Gaming Control Board has an obligation to deal with that. So there's an example where they added somebody to the Black Book based not on gambling or on the mob, but on something very different, which is sex trafficking. And then more recently, this story has sort of been betrayed in an interesting way in the media. Basically, the most recent person added to the book in December of 2023 was a man named Sean Joseph Benward. And he's described in news reports as a magician. So what are we saying here now? Are we sort of in the like Lord of the Rings territory here? No, he is a trained magician in the sense that he's performed on stage doing magic tricks. But what he tried to do was to use those skills to manipulate roulette dealers and roulette games to his advantage. And so he actually was, he's before he entered the Black Book in Nevada, he was already in the Black Books in several other states, including Pennsylvania, Delaware, Missouri, and Michigan. And in each of those states, he had been, you know, scamming roulette games. And he did this oftentimes by directing the attention of the individuals in such a way so that he could manipulate the game. And it was kind of a complicated process, but he was caught doing it in multiple states. So he's not quite the magician that he's been portrayed. But here's a case of a casino cheat, yes, but a casino cheat of a different kind. He doesn't have any mirrors or anybody talking to him in his ear, or he's not bending cards or anything like that. He was using his skills as of misdirection and the skills of a magician to try to win.
Has the Black Book both, I mean, in Nevada and other jurisdictions, you've mentioned a few of the other jurisdictions that have similar lists. Has this helped to sort of improve the perception of the gaming industry in Las Vegas and in Nevada?
You know, I think it has. I think it's fairly clear that the institution of the Black Book has helped to improve the public perception of Nevada's gambling industry. It shows sort of this very tangible effort on the part of the state to keep bad people out of the casinos. But that's a perception. As far as reality, I don't know if the casinos have any more actual integrity because of the Black Book, or it's probably more about the corporate accounting and the careful processes that they maintain in order to achieve the integrity they desire. So I think that's a bigger part of the actual integrity than the Black Book is.
And as I say, you've mentioned a few other jurisdictions that have something similar. It's not a uniquely Nevada thing. This is something that is in place, it sounds like, pretty much anywhere where there is legalized gaming.
Yeah, and you know, it was first in Nevada. We'll take it as being the first. But when New Jersey legalized gambling in Atlantic City in 1976, and the first casinos there opened in 1978, New Jersey was extremely concerned about mob involvement in the casinos and all of the other kinds of cheaters and others who could really hurt the integrity of the games. And so New Jersey created what they call their exclusion list, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people on this list. Now, partly that might have to do with just the mere population on the East Coast, right? But I think it also has to do just with their desire to maintain that actual integrity when there are so many threats right around them. And, you know, they could not keep the mob out of New Jersey, out of Atlantic City back in the 80s and 90s. So even with all of that effort, the mob still found its way in.
Are there any books or documentaries that you'd recommend for people to dive into with the regards to the Black Book?
Yeah, there are two books in particular that I would call people's attention to. The first one is kind of, until somebody writes a better one, it's kind of the Bible of this story. And that's a book called The Black Book and the Mob, The Untold Story of the Control of Nevada's Casinos. And this was published in 1995. It's not that hard to find, though. Published in 1995 by the University of Wisconsin Press. A couple of researchers, academics named Ronald Farrell and Carol Case put that together. But I'll tell you, it is an easy read. And it is, I would say, the most comprehensive look at the Black Book and the individual cases in the Black Book that exists right now. That book came out in 1995. So somebody is due for an update. The other book that I would recommend, and I recommend it in general, but specifically on the Black Book, is Oscar Goodman's memoir called Being Oscar, from Mob Lawyer to Mayor of Las Vegas. And Oscar co-wrote this book with George Anastasia, the great mob writer from Philadelphia. And chapter five of Being Oscar is all about the Black Book cases that he defended, where he defended nominated individuals. And, you know, Oscar was a vocal critic of the Black Book. He believed then, and he believes now, that it's unconstitutional. He makes the argument that, and I have the quote here, you know, there's almost no way to defend against an allegation that doesn't have to be proven. In other words, they can say, you have an unsavory reputation, so we're going to put you in the Black Book. How do you defend that? Right? What does unsavory reputation mean? And how do you, they don't have to prove you have an unsavory reputation. They just say you do.
Right.
So, however, you know, this constitutional issue was decided before Oscar started defending mobsters. Courts had ruled, the first ruling in support of the Black Book occurred in the 1960s. And then subsequent rulings defended the Black Book too. And the rationale for its existence is that Nevada's gaming industry is a privileged industry. Like, not everybody, you know, can be in gaming. You have to be licensed to do so, and you're doing so at the good graces of the state government. So, if knowing that the state government has control over licenses, one could presume it can have regulation can extend to the Black Book. So, you can see both sides of it, but there's a nice discussion of that topic in Oscar's book.
It's that argument of rights versus privileges, in that it's almost like holding a casino license or being able to go into a casino is it's a privilege, not necessarily a right. But at the same time, you've got the right to sort of be able to go where you want and not have somebody, as you say, sully your reputation just because they say you did bad things and they have no proof of it.
Well, an example of this that people get confused about is card counters, right? When you think about it, being a good card counter is not cheating. It's being really, really good at playing cards, right? But the casino still will kick you out if they identify you as a card counter, and that's because they can, right? Because it's a privileged industry, they can decide. You know, it's a, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service kind of mindset where, you know, even though you're not doing something illegal that's going to get you a jail sentence or anything like that, we don't want you here. So you're out. And that's what you get with the privileged industry.
Not a problem for me. I had somebody try to explain to me how to count cards, and I was like, no.
No, it's not I'm not a numbers person either, but I do admire the ability to concentrate on that level and be able to. It's like saying, you know, you're having a chess tournament and somebody's really good at chess because they can think three steps ahead of you or five steps or whatever the number is. And, oh, I'm sorry, you're out because you're too good at this. You know, that doesn't make sense. So.
Jeff, I appreciate you taking the time, sir, to come on and have a conversation about the Black Book. It's fascinating, and it's got a really, really interesting history. And as I said off the top, I thought it was time to cover this and dive deep into it, and I figured you were the guy to do it. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I'm glad you thought of me, and happy to talk about all things Vegas, whatever you want.
Thanks again, Jeff.
Thanks.
And that wraps up another episode of Jeff Does Vegas. If you've got feedback on this episode of the show, or any other episode for that matter, or you've got suggestions and ideas for topics you'd like me to cover on the podcast, please feel free to reach out via social media on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Jeff Does Vegas. You can also email me directly at jeff@jeffdoesvegas.com. In the meantime, thanks for checking out the show. Be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll be notified the instant a new episode is released. While you're there, go ahead and rate us and write a review. And don't forget to visit jeffdoesvegas.com for past episodes, show notes, Vegas deals, and more. My name is Jeff, and this has been Jeff Does Vegas, a Walker New Media production.
This program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.